This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have a host discussion on the fairness hearing in the cases of Raza v. City of New York and Hanshu v. Special Services Division.
What can the New York City police do? Who can they spy on? What controls do we have over them? Let's talk about that. We talk with Miko Pellid about his just republished book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He joins us in the studio to talk about the second edition of his book and about his impressions from a recent visit to Hebron in the West Bank. We talk with Chicago attorney Flint Taylor, a partner in the anti-police abuse law firm, the People's Law Office. The results of the commission appointed by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel have just been published. It is a devastating indictment of the racist and unaccountable Chicago Police Department.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, 2 weeks ago, you were in federal court, not this time as an attorney, but this time as a witness, and you were commenting on the proposed Hanshu settlement regarding the supervision of the New York City Police Department when it spies on movement groups.
Yes, Michael, I actually submitted written testimony, as did many other people, at what's called a fairness hearing before federal Judge Charles Haight, who's presided over the so-called Hanshu v. Special Services Division case for over four decades. And we've had several of the Hanshu attorneys, Paul Cheveny and others, on Law and Disorder over the years, but they've also really stuck with this case over the long haul. And what it involves basically is what limits are placed on NYPD spying on political and religious organizations and individuals in New York City. The settlement originally, much like the federal attorney general guidelines to curb FBI spying on political and religious groups, on a more local level, set forth things that the police can and cannot do. But over the years, as we've seen with the attorney general guidelines, they've been really watered down, especially after the events of 9/11. The NYPD went into court repeatedly saying that it needed not to have restrictions on how it could spy in order to root out terrorism. So they've become virtually meaningless guidelines. And what happened is the case of Raza v. City of New York, which involved widespread spying on Muslim communities absent suspicion of, you know, criminal activity afoot, when that became known through the AP reports and other news stories, a lawsuit was filed alleging that it was unconstitutional to spy on mosques and Muslim communities without probable cause, and also that it had what we call a chilling effect on the exercise of religion. Knowing that your mosque may be infiltrated or monitored necessarily has an effect on how you worship and what you say in that environment.
How many bad guys did the New York City police catch with this kind of surveillance?
To my understanding, they haven't caught any, Michael. Just as in the federal cases, they haven't really rooted out any real terrorist threats.
So what do you think the likelihood that the police are going to abuse their authority and engage in unconstitutional surveillance that could chill free speech and free association?
Michael, we have one of the largest counterterrorism forces within the NYPD in the world, and they pride themselves on their aggressive tactics. A large amount of money, as you know, is funneled into that department. I think that even the proposed settlement terms, which the plaintiffs in Raza are understandably hoping will be approved, I think are really inadequate to prevent against the continued, really unrestrained and often protracted in duration surveillance that we have seen this police department use.
If the city political police want to spy on a group, Do they need to get permission from anybody? What do they do? What's the procedure?
They have two different kinds of investigations, preliminary investigations and full investigations. And the standard for full investigations is lower than probable cause. It's called reasonable indication. I think that standard increases the chance that law enforcement will abuse their authority because they could justify many different types of activities under that standard. That also allows them to engage not only in unconstitutional surveillance, but of infiltration of these groups. And that, of course, sows distrust, especially among activist organizations that often rely on volunteers to carry out their work and that often don't screen those volunteers because they want to be inclusive and have a broad spectrum of representatives. I mentioned in my comments a group that we've talked about on this program, the Campaign to Bring Mumia Abu-Jamal Home, which was created in 2013. And as you know, they have been, along with other pro-Mumia groups, targeted often by the Fraternal Order of Police. So it seems to me that if police in New York City already don't like a group like that, they may use their personal animosity to decide to open up an investigation, be it short-term or long-term, and monitor the group's activities. I also think that there's what they call a three-year presumptive limit of durations on full investigations. It also has the ability to be renewed. And I think that when people in New York know that these investigations can go on for that long, it contributes to the feeling that they may be monitored for no reason at all, and then it may be continuing. It's sort of like having a drone hovering over you for days or weeks. You suspect it may be there, but you don't know when they're watching you. And if they're watching you, it could be for 24-hour periods, 7 days a week, you know, weeks on end. That knowledge itself has a chilling effect.
Is there any transparency to this process? How do we find out this is going on? What can we do about it?
Well, one thing that I think is also a problem that dovetails with your question, Michael, is that there are no adequate mechanisms for civilian review and oversight of these practices. I think in many cases we found out by accident that groups have been monitored when the media uncovers it or people file a Freedom of Information or a FOIL, as it's called locally, request, and sometimes it leaks out that an individual or a group had been the target. The problem with, as I see it, with these proposed settlements is that they are proposing what they're calling the Hanshu Committee that will have one civilian member, and that will be an attorney. But the other members of it are all police and high-level police officials, such as the Chief of Intelligence, the Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence, the Commanding Officer of the Intelligence Operations and Analysis Section. They're all bigwigs like that. And the mayor appoints this one civilian representative, but can also replace that person with just 2 weeks' notice to the council in Hanshu and Raza. And I think that this is really a token representative with no teeth, because how can one civilian representative really stand up to all of those high-ranking police officials? It's going to be very difficult, and it's not a civilian oversight body. It should at least have as many civilian representatives as law enforcement, or be all civilian, and have some clout to it.
Well, this oversight board certainly seems ineffectual with respect to civilian control.
And let me just add, Michael, sorry to interrupt, that after 5 years, the mayor can actually abolish or modify the position of lone civilian representative. So we think this should, I think a lot of people who are critical of this think this should be a permanent position, and that civilian representation should be expanded to have more positions on this committee.
Were there people other than yourself, Heidi, that were critical of this proposed settlement?
Well, representatives of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild did praise, of course, the work that went into reaching the settlements and the longstanding work both of the class counsel and Judge Haight, and had some proposed modifications, they also focused on the fact that the Hanshu Committee didn't really seem to have clout and had a few other comments. But when I was there for the morning session, that was the only group that had any feedback that was critical in any way. A lot of the plaintiffs got up and spoke and urged that these proposed guidelines be approved. I heard that in the afternoon session, which I wasn't able to attend, a few more people did say that they felt it wasn't strong enough.
So here we have a police force with a budget that's well over $1 billion. A few years ago, one of the top leaders of the CIA was hired by the New York City Police Force to head up this group. It seems to me that this is going to be secret police activity, monitoring the legal, political activities of New York City residents without any really effective oversight or governance.
I think that's exactly right, Michael. We have such a well-resourced and really sophisticated intelligence and anti-terrorism units here that require a strong set of guidelines to effectively limit police surveillance and infiltration of political and religious groups. And I think that the people of New York deserve nothing less. Michael, I hear you have an update on the late Justice Scalia.
Antonin Scalia died a couple months ago, as listeners know, and George Mason School of Law down in the Washington, D.C. area took two grants, one of them by David Koch, to rename the School of Law the Antonin Scalia School of Law. And that was the official name for a couple of days till they realized that the
acronym
was Ass Law. Which was, I thought, totally fitting for the Scalia School of Law. But they withdrew the name, they kept the money, and they still got Scalia's name in there. And if any listeners want to go to the Scalia School of Law, more power to you.
Niko Peled comes from a distinguished Zionist family. His grandfather, in 1948... signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father, General Mati Peled, was a hero in Israel's victorious 1967 war against three of its Arab neighbors. Niko Peled wrote the book The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine in 2012. It is an account of his family history and his own personal and political and moral evolution. He served in the Israeli Air Force. His sister's young daughter was killed by a Palestinian in a terrorist attack. His book is considered so important that it's been republished in a new updated second edition just this month. Peled moved from Israel and now lives in San Diego. He is active in the Palestine solidarity struggle. He believes that the only just solution in Israel-Palestine is for the creation of a binational state with equal rights for the Palestinian people. He's in New York now on tour to promote the second edition of his book. Niko Peled, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Your mother, to whom you dedicated your book, her father was one of the signers in 1948 of the Israeli Declaration of Independence. And your father, Mati Peled, was one of the heroes of the 1967 war, which Israel conducted against three of its neighbors and which resulted in the capture of what we now call the occupied territories, including Jerusalem. So I wanted to ask you, before we get into your book and your recent trip over to Israel and the occupied territories, I wanted to ask you if you'd share with us a little bit about your family background.
Sure. My grandparents on my mother's side came from Belarus. On my father's side, they came from Ukraine. Came to colonize Palestine and establish a so-called Jewish state in Palestine. And on my mother's side, the entire family was very much politically involved. They were kind of the upper class, you know, Jews. And my grandfather was one of the, you know, spokesmen and leaders of the Zionist movement. As a young man, he would travel and speak around the world, and he was a member of the UN delegation, and he did a lot of work within the Zionist movement in Palestine. He established the Ministry of Health, for example. He was supposed to be the first health minister, but that didn't work out in the end. And so when the time came and the Declaration of Independence was proclaimed, he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He was one of the members of what they called the National Council, which was like the government, but for the pre-state governments. And that is quite a legacy. You know, that was something we were all very proud of. Many people still are. My dad comes from a very, you know, working class Jewish family, poor and kind of, you know, completely different kind of life. But he joined the Zionist militia, the Zionist, what today we would probably call a terrorist organization, the Palmach, became an officer. And then when what we call the War of Independence, or the War of 1948, began, he was right there to fight for the cause, you know, participating in this, in what we know today to be a heinous crime of ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And then he remained in the military as an officer, and he became a career officer. And in the early 60s, he was a general, and by 1967, he was a member of the Israeli High Command. And as we know, they were considered, or they're considered by Israeli standards, to be like the gods on the Olympus. They, as young officers, won the War of 48, in which most of Palestine was occupied, and then they, as generals, they won the War of 1967, and where the occupation of Palestine was completed, and all of Palestine became the Jewish state, the State of Israel. So that's the legacy.
In your case, Miko, the apple didn't fall far from the tree initially, because you grew up and you joined the Israeli Air Force.
Not the Air Force. I mean, I was conscripted. The Israeli Army is, you know, there's conscription in Israel. It's mandatory. So I, just like everybody else, you know, joined. I mean, I joined happily. I was very proud. I mean, young Israelis were taught to be proud of the fact and look forward to the day that we are called to serve in the military and so on. And so I was eager to do what everybody else did. But I mean, I never thought of having a military career like my dad. But during the service, that was kind of one of my first moments of awakening as to what is actually taking place, and the fact that the Israeli army is not a moral army, it's an army of occupation, and the fact that trampling on Palestinian land and trampling on Palestinian lives is really means nothing to the Israeli forces, means nothing to the Israeli army, and basically means nothing to Israelis at all. And that was something that I didn't feel I could live with.
So you eventually emigrated to the United States, but you've been back to Israel. You were just over there very recently. What were your impressions as compared to what it was like when you were growing up? Have things changed dramatically, say even more violent now than it was in the past? What was it like for you visiting Hebron and now coming back? Can you share those impressions with us?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't immigrate consciously. I came to the U.S. I thought I would stay for a short while and ended up, starting a life here and staying here for a long time. And I've been visiting, I go back to Palestine, I go back to Jerusalem a lot. This last visit was very disturbing. And the comparison, you know, when I grew up, I didn't know anything. Because when you live as an Israeli, when you live as a Jew in Israel, then you live in a completely different sphere than Palestinians do. And there's no connection and there's no reason to think that or to know about what is happening on the other side, even though it could be, you know, across the street. So Israelis, as an Israeli, you live in this la-la land and this sphere, much like, you know, whites in America, I suppose, and so forth. I mean, you don't know what's going on, and you think it's a beautiful, wonderful democracy. In the years that I've become active, and I have ventured into that other sphere, the sphere of the oppressed, the sphere of the occupied, the sphere of the Palestinians, the reality is horrifying, and it's hard to say. I mean, it has its ups and downs. I don't know that it's necessarily worse, because there have been some very bad times over the 70 years of the existence of Israel. But now it's the tensions are very high. I was in Hebron just a few days after this young soldier executed a Palestinian who was laying on the ground. Everybody saw that video or should have seen that video, where a young Palestinian that was already shot and wounded and dying on the ground was then executed by a soldier who shot him in the head for no reason other than he was a Palestinian. And the tensions in Hebron are always very, very high because the Palestinians are their existence is between the settlers, who are these rabidly zealous, violent people, a society that is so violent and so fanatic that it's hard to really express in words. You have to see it to believe it, including their children. I mean, I've never seen children like this in my life. And the Israeli military that supports the settlers. And so Palestinians have no recourse. So if a Palestinian is shot and killed, he's shot and killed. Nobody cares. And the sense of the activist, the Palestinian activist in Hebron, is one that they have to be very, very cautious where they go, when they step. I mean, the Palestinian that was actually executed, they call him a terrorist, and they said that he, you know, the justification is that he supposedly tried to stab a soldier. He did nothing of the kind. There was another Palestinian who stabbed the soldiers. This particular guy, Abdel Fattah al-Sharif, his hands were up. He was not part of that at all. He just happened to be there. He raised his hands and he was shot in the stomach by soldiers, lay on the ground. Then we see the ambulances, the Israeli ambulances going all around him, not taking care of him, not even looking at him. And then suddenly this young soldier comes up, talks to an officer. It's very clear he hands the officer his helmet and then, you know, gets his gun ready, gets close and shoots the guy in the head. And the officer's looking at him the whole time. So it's obvious that he was either operating under an order or he had consent to do what he did. And now the entire state of Israel pretty much is supporting this guy. They're behind this guy saying he was only doing his job and why are we, you know, he's being prosecuted for manslaughter. And the reality in Israel, and the discourses in Israel, is so incredibly racist. It's so incredibly violent. It's so incredibly one-sided. There is no dissent at all. There's no sense of, I mean, nobody dares to say, well, maybe we have a problem here because we've been occupying this country and so forth. Nobody says that. And the difference between today and, say, when I was growing up, is that in the early years, Israeli governments pretended that they wanted peace, pretended they were peace-loving people, pretended that they wanted to find a solution to live in peace with their neighbors, pretended. In fact, they wanted nothing of the kind, and their actions show that. Today, they drop the pretense, they drop the facade, and they just do what they, you know, they just do what they want. They don't even pretend that they want something else.
Well, you've written a really fine book that I would recommend to our audience. It's called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And now there's a new edition after 4 years, which is quite commendable that the book was so highly thought of that it's coming out again. And I wanted to ask you, what changes or additions did you make to the new edition of The General's Son?
The main difference is that I wrote an epilogue that kind of a rather long one. It's a pretty long chapter that was added and describes what happened over the last 4 years. The journey, you know, the journey of an Israeli in Palestine continues. I'm still an Israeli, it's still Palestine, and I'm still discovering and learning things. You know, one part, excuse me, that I talk about in the epilogue, or one episode, is my trip to Gaza. I tried to go into Gaza several times and I wasn't able to. As an Israeli, the Israeli authorities won't allow me to go in through Israel. The Egyptian authorities keep the Rafah border closed almost all the time. And then at one point, a friend from Gaza asked me if I would consider coming in through the subway.
The tunnel.
Yeah, what they called it, the subway. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that, yeah. And so it was a trip that really, if you drive from Jerusalem to Gaza, it's maybe 90 minutes, if that. It took 14 hours. I had to cross three borders. I had to break the laws of at least two different countries. I had to be smuggled in through a tunnel. And 14, 15 hours later, I was in Gaza, which is about 90 minutes away from Jerusalem, where I left that morning. So it was a harrowing trip. But of course, being in Gaza was, it was comforting in a way, because being in Palestine always feels comforting to me. it was horrifying because of the destruction, because every family has loved ones that were killed by Israel. You know, every building you look at has been, you see the signs of the missiles and so forth, and the violence that Israel has been imposing on Gaza. And you see the signs of the siege, you know, lack of food, lack of water, lack of medicine, and so on. So that, again, that is one, you know, part of the journey, that, you know, the ongoing journey that, like I said, still goes on.
Yeah, the school that my sister Melinda taught in Gaza was completely demolished. Let's talk about the United States. I know you're a valued part of the solidarity movement here, and that movement has been growing in strength, I think. And I wanted to ask you how you evaluate where that movement is going and how it's doing.
Well, it is growing in leaps and bounds. The conversation over the last 5 years in America about Palestine has been changed dramatically, mostly thanks to groups like Students for Justice in Palestine on campuses and to the BDS movement that have been doing tremendous work and I think are both integral part of the Palestinian resistance. And what's interesting is that in Israel, they suddenly discovered that this is happening in the United States. And when I mean suddenly, I literally mean suddenly. So over the last couple of months, Yediot Ahronot, one of the major Israeli newspaper, has been writing scathing articles and reports about this, you know, this new anti-Semitic monster that's out there to devour Jews, which is called the BDS. And the BDS includes all aspects of the Solidarity Movement. Yediot Ahronot, together with Stand With Us, put together a major conference in Jerusalem, which I attended because I happened to be in Jerusalem at the time, where the president of the State of Israel spoke, cabinet ministers, all the important journalists, Ron Lauder was there. I mean, you know, how we combat this thing. And the only person that dared to say that there might be a connection between the BDS and the occupation was Boud. This was the ambassador of the European Union who was there to speak. And he was booed when he dared to hint that perhaps there's a connection between these two things. And now Israeli TV, Channel 10, did a documentary. They sent a crew here to the United States to see, you know, to actually document this. And they did a five-chapter series about the BDS. They interviewed me, they interviewed Chomsky, they interviewed Hatem Bazian, they interviewed activists. My son is an activist at UCLA. And they're discovering that this monster, anti-Semitic monster, which they knew existed in Europe, is now coming to the U.S. And of course, they're hyping it and they're making it seem violent and anti-Semitic, none of which is true. It's a very legitimate, it's a principled form of resistance. And going back to your original question, yes, I think it's doing very well, though sadly it's not going fast enough. So for the Palestinians that are being killed on the streets now and for the ones who have to live under the Israeli occupation, all the different varieties of the Israeli occupation, because it varies from place to place, I don't think we're moving fast enough.
You've written in favor of a binational state with equal rights for both Palestinians and Israelis. Why do you think that this is preferable to a two-state solution?
Well, it's not just that it's preferable, it's the only reality that exists. The two-state solution is no longer a choice. I don't believe it was ever a real choice. I think it was a scam. In the late 60s, early 70s, guys like my dad and others, I think, really believed that this was going to solve the problem. But establishing a small Palestinian state in areas of Palestine that Israel determined, with a limited autonomy that Israel determines, with an economy and ties and military that are all determined by Israel, is really not going to solve the problem. And the reality is that Israel had never any interest in this. The fact is that they built the West Bank, just like they built other parts of the country for Jews only, and that was it. So this argument that somehow the occupied territories are the West Bank and Gaza, I think, is absurd. All of Palestine is occupied. The occupation didn't start in 1967. The occupation started in 1948. It was completed in 1967, and now we have the State of Israel over all of the entire country. So there already is a binational state, and it was created by Israel, importing Jews to come and colonize Palestine and so on. So the question is, do we want, or are we willing to allow this very racist apartheid regime, very brutal, violent regime that exists there now, which is the State of Israel, and has been occupying Palestine for 7 decades, to continue, which I don't think is realistic. I think it's going to fall apart. Or do we push for a peaceful transition into a democracy that represents all the people and guarantees equal rights. And it, once we have that, once we have a representative government that represents all the people, then we can start dealing with the issues, because Israel will never allow the refugees to return. Israel will never release the thousands of political prisoners. Israel will never on its own end the siege on Gaza and so forth. But once we have this transition, which hopefully will come sooner rather than later, then this representative government that represents the people, really represents all the people, can start dealing with these issues and hopefully resolve them.
If Hillary Clinton becomes president, what are her positions on the Israeli-Palestine conflict?
I don't think Hillary Clinton has a position. I don't think she cares. She follows the party line because that's what she needs to do to get elected, and that's what she needs to get AIPAC support. And I don't think Hillary Clinton is going to make any changes in what's, you know, the reality on the ground. And I don't think any American president really will. I think the change will come from the bottom up. So to expect that an American president will somehow change American policy in the Middle East is not realistic. It doesn't matter if it's her or if it's Trump or if it's anybody else. An American president will change American policy only when the reality on the ground is such that politically they have no choice. The day American politicians feel they don't have to bow to AIPAC, that they don't have to support Israel and provide Israel with a blank check every year, that'll be the day that things change. They don't do it because they love Israel or because they care or any of that mythology that exists about some strategic or value relations or anything like that that have to do with shared values. This has to do with internal American politics. It has to do with AIPAC. And the day that they can feel free to do what they, or they feel that they have to do the right thing, they will do the right thing, being politicians. Bernie Sanders, in a way, opened that door a little bit when he criticized Israel for the massacre in Gaza. That was the first time any major politician dared to speak up and say anything against Israel publicly, and that was a courageous move. I think he put everything on the line by saying that. And then calling out Hillary Clinton for not speaking up for Palestine while she spoke at AIPAC. So that was, you know, that was unprecedented and may be the beginning of something new in American politics, where American politicians feel they can do this and the sky doesn't fall. But we'll have to wait and see. I think if we on the ground don't do our work properly, it doesn't matter who the president is, nothing's going to change. If we do the work properly, it doesn't matter who the president is, there will be change.
We've been speaking with Miko Peled, who wrote the book The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. The second edition is just out. I've been active in Palestine solidarity work since 1967, and this is one of the best books out there, and people should get it and read it. Before we have to say goodbye to Miko, do you have any last thoughts for our audience?
Sure. I would love to see more people involved in the Palestine Solidarity. I would love to see more people embrace BDS, the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, speak about it freely. I think it's important for people to stop talking about the occupation or the occupied territories as though they are just limited parts of Palestine, because all of Palestine is occupied. It's been occupied for 7 decades. All of Israel is occupied Palestine. All Israeli cities and towns are illegal settlements, and we have to start talking about it in those terms. Otherwise, we'll never reach the solution, which relies on this, on understanding this, and accepting the fact that we need to push for a transformation and an establishment of a democratic regime in Palestine.
Miko Peled, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Chicago attorney Flint Taylor is a founding partner in the People's Law Office. He's been engaged in police abuse litigation since the 1960s, when he and his partner, Jeff Haas, represented the Fred Hampton family after Chairman Hampton, the head of the Black Panther Party, was assassinated by the Chicago police and the FBI. Flint then, for 30 years, represented the victims of the John Burge torture machine. Burge, with the use of torture, got false confessions from over 100 African-American men, sending them to prison. Recently, under a court order, a video was released showing the execution by the Chicago police of a young black man named Laquan McDonald. In the wake of the release of the tape, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel was forced to fire his police chief and appoint a commission to investigate the lack of accountability and widespread racism in the Chicago Police Department. We speak today with Attorney Flint Taylor about the findings of the commission, the role of organizations in Chicago in trying to protect the community, and where he thinks the movement must go next. Flint Taylor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Happy to be back with you, Mike.
Well, Flint, before we go into the current situation in Chicago, I wanted to share your background with our audience, because you've been dealing with the Chicago Police Department really for your whole career, even while you were a law student. You and Jeff Haas were involved in representing the family after Chairman Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party was assassinated. And I wanted to ask you just a little bit about your victory in that case, and then your work in exposing John Burge and his torture squad that operated for many years out of the west side of Chicago. And then let's get up to the current situation in Chicago, because it's really quite interesting what's going on there now. But first, give us an idea what the Chicago Police Department is like, with your experience with them with respect to the Fred Hampton assassination and the Burge torture machine.
Well, from the beginning, what we learned the hard way, and that is being involved in, as you say, the Fred Hampton Black Panther assassination and dealing with the torture cases here in Chicago, learned how deeply racist and systemically racist the department is, and how violent it is. And by violent, I mean not only killing Black Panthers in their bed when they become too big a threat to the perceived powers that be, but also when they want to fight crime and give the impression of fighting gangs and other serious crimes, that they can use torture techniques systemically that include electric shock, bagging, suffocation, mock executions, all directed at what turns out to be over 125 African-American men on the south and later on the west side of Chicago under the auspices of John Burge. And so we and people at the office and, of course, various intergenerational movements over the decades have fought against these issues, raised these issues, exposed these issues. So now we get to the present day, and we're seeing it being recognized, at least to some limited degree, by this commission that has looked into the current situation in Chicago with regard to the police.
The court-ordered release of the videotape that showed the police murder of this young teenage black man named Laquan McDonald, in my opinion, from afar, seemed to be a really qualitative turning point here. And I wanted to ask you about the Laquan McDonald murder and what happened as a result of it.
Well, the murder, the police murder, happened in 2014. And the video was known at least to some very, very high-level people in the Emanuel administration right after that. And, of course, at that time, Several things were going on in the city, and paramount was that there was the run-up to the February 2015 mayoral election. And at that point, Rahm was under a serious challenge, first by Karen Lewis, who was the dynamic leader of the Chicago Teachers Union and still is. And then when she was struck with cancer, the movement switched to Chuy Garcia, a very well-known progressive politician here in the city. So Rahm was under tremendous pressure. The black community was extremely upset with him because he'd shut down 50 schools, because he'd shut down several mental health clinics, and he was trying to save his image, particularly in the black community. And that's why we, in the movement for reparations for victims of police torture that came out of the Burge torture scandal, we were getting quite a bit of a listening ear from the mayor and his people at that point, because he wanted to mend fences with the African-American community, and he thought that by agreeing to reparations for men who were tortured by Burge, that would be a feather in his cap politically. And of course, the movement, and we were able to capitalize on that and ultimately obtain reparations and the city's approval of them in April of 2015. But at the same time, they're sitting on this videotape, which if it came out, he was quite rightly, and his people were quite rightly worried that all the, quote, good that he was trying to do in mending his fences and fighting for his life in the first the primary and later in the general election in April would be for naught. So his lawyers, and he has a very powerful, savvy corporation counsel who came from the corporate ranks and who cut his teeth defending tobacco companies and forging billion-dollar settlements, got together with the lawyers for Laquan McDonald and his family, who was, of course, the man who was murdered in cold blood by the police and on video. And they worked out a deal that the McDonald family didn't even have to file a lawsuit. They agreed to a $5 million settlement. With the stipulation that the videotape would stay under wraps, under a protective order. And that, in fact, ironically, became known the same week that the reparations was agreed to. In fact, the day after, and it was in the mid-April, the week after Rahm had survived the general election, the settlement was approved by city council. The video was mentioned by the corporation counsel, and then journalists and lawyers who had already been digging around the case, because they had gotten an autopsy report that showed that there were 16 bullets that Laquan McDonald had suffered. So they already knew there was something very, very seriously wrong with the shooting. And so when the video, when it was mentioned publicly, the journalists went after it on a Freedom of Information Act request, and after several months, a courageous Cook County judge ordered it released. So now we're 13 months later, after the killing, and the video's coming out. So the video's coming out over Thanksgiving, and the city and the state's attorney are running extremely scared because they know what's going to happen when the video becomes public. So the former now state's attorney, Anita Alvarez, the morning that the video is going to come out, indicts the cops. She hadn't the cop, Van Dyke, who hadn't been charged in 13 months despite this video. So that's the kind of the background to when the video came out around Thanksgiving of 2015.
Well, didn't the state's attorney, she didn't get reelected, and didn't the police chief get fired?
All of that happened. In the wake of it, several things happened. Rahm was on the defensive from the jump, and the state's attorney was as well. She was voted out this March, I think primarily on the basis that she not only was involved in this cover-up and only indicted Van Dyke because the video came out, but also she was, you know, a very, very disliked entity, particularly in the African-American community, because she was law and order. She was a straight line from Daley to Devine, who were machine, obviously, prosecutors and racist prosecutors, right, to her. And so she had a real background in covering up, in wrongful convictions, and all sorts of things that alienated the community. So when this was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, and she was voted out very, very roundly. I think there was a very progressive African-American woman named Kim Fox who ran against her, and she got 60% of the vote.
That's
Alvarez got about 30%. So she's gone. They fired McCarthy, the police superintendent, Rahm did. He fired the head of the disciplinary agency, and he created his own little commission. And he did that with the hopes, I think, that the Justice Department would not come in and investigate. But lo and behold, within 3 or 4 days of his creating this commission, the Justice Department and Loretta Lynch did announce that they were going to come in and do a pattern and practice investigation of the Chicago Police Department.
Well, let's talk a bit about this commission. Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, appoints this commission. And the commission issues a report, and I wanted to read you something from the report. Quote, "The Chicago Police Department's own data give validity to the widely held belief of African Americans that the police have no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color." And then it gives the following statistics. Now, Chicago is a city of about one-third African American. 70% of people killed in recent times by the cops were African American. 70% of the people tasered were African American. 46% of people stopped while they were driving. 72% of street stops are African American. 70% of all young African American men have been stopped within the last 12 months. I mean, that's quite amazing. And then they say that there's no accountability for the acts of the police. And then they say that the police are totally racist. So this is a commission appointed by Rahm Emanuel himself. Question is, what's going to become of this?
Well, that's a good question. And I guess as the younger generations would say in response to what you just read to me, duh, we've been saying this for decades. We've been developing this evidence. We've been confronting the city and the police department and the mayor and the state's attorney with this systemic evidence from back in the 80s when we started to do the Monell pattern and practice cases against the department. So this is nothing new. It is, as you point out, rather remarkable for a city commission that was commissioned by the mayor to make these kind of findings. And in that sense, we certainly have to applaud the commission. The question about what's going to happen to it is a very good question. This, as I said, this commission was appointed by Emanuel to try to avoid the Justice Department. Now, the Justice Department is here. I assume the Justice Department will take heed of all of the findings that this commission made, because this commission has no power in of itself to implement anything that it has said. It is basically a commission for the mayor, by the mayor, and he can accept it. He can, to the extent that he wants to, direct the police department to implement these reforms, but we haven't quite heard any of that as of yet. And I would point out, Michael, that the one thing, or one of the things that this report does not do, is to assess blame and to look at the mayor's role in all of this. Not only this mayor, but it pays lip service to the scandals of the Fred Hampton case, the Burge case, and other outrageous systemic and racist police activities over the years. But it doesn't point to the fact that Mayor Richard M. Daley was intimately involved in all of that. And it doesn't look at Rahm's role in this issue of the videotape and why it was covered up. It glosses over it and instead just basically applauds itself for creating a video policy of releasing videos within 60 days. So we have to also look at what it did not do and ask questions about how, if at all, any of these reforms are going to be implemented. It doesn't go outside of the parameters of any other police department in this country, and we all and it looks to places like New York and L.A. and Seattle, which of course have certainly reforms that are not here in Chicago. But on the other hand, they certainly aren't systems or police departments that we can really take a lot of solace in terms of what they do and do not do.
We've been talking with Flint Taylor, who is a founding partner of the great People's Law Office out in Chicago. And Flint, your People's Law Office has been one of the organizations in Chicago that's been so vigorously involved in all of this. But I wanted to ask you, there's a real movement in Chicago, it seems to me. What are the other forces in Chicago involved in keeping this whole issue of police abuse on the front burner?
Well, there have been a series of organizations and movements here in the city, movements that go back to the start of my career, at least, in fighting and raising the issues of police violence and brutality in the Fred Hampton case and later in the torture cases. Most recently, of course, the local Black Lives Matter movement. There was a wonderful organization called We Charge Genocide that was also Daughters of Asada is another organization that's very important. Black Youth Project 100. These are all organizations along with the Chicago Torture Justice Memorials that came together with us and other lawyers and activists to fight for the reparations, and now has been in the streets ever since this video came out and had a major impact on getting Alvarez ousted from office. But we should also note that these organizations chose not to cooperate with the commission and that they felt that reforms within the system were not sufficient and could not be sufficient. And Mike, I think like the more radical aspects of the prison movement, which talk about abolishing prisons, some of the young people here and some of those organizations here with regard to police are not only raising the fundamental underlying questions of education, health care, mental health, that kind of thing, the fundamental underpinnings of poverty and racism, but they're raising the question of defunding the police department, not of making changes in it or shoring it up or making better community police relations, but in fact defunding police and abolishing police, so to speak, as the idea of abolishing prisons. Now, that seems to be a kind of way out idea to a lot of us older people, but on the other hand, I think we have to understand that we need to think about those issues and as well as the quote reform issues.
We've been talking with Attorney Flint Taylor. Flint, we're running out of our allotted time, but before I say goodbye to you, do you have any last thoughts for our audience?
Well, I think that we need to understand that this isn't a new phenomenon. Yes, it's important to show that it's systemic and it's racist and that the police are fundamentally at fault for much that is wrong in the community. But we have to understand the idea of police and the idea that police have always been an occupying force in communities of color and poor communities. And I think we need to have that overview whenever we're looking at whether it be a report or whether we're looking at a videotape of a police murder, and that we have to understand not only the idea of reform, but we have to also understand the more radical ideas that our young people are raising in the streets.
Flint Taylor, thank you so much for your good work over the years and for being a guest on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
I will, Michael, and thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. So long.
Right. Bye now.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Thank you.